On Tour is a production of iHeartRadio and Black Barrel Media. I'm your host, Brian Ray. I've been a musician for 40 years. I started as a teenager with Etta James, Smokey Robinson, and most recently with Paul McCartney for 19 years. On this show, we'll take you behind the scenes of the music business to give you the most raw and real tales you've likely never heard before. I'll get into the highs and lows of the touring industry, who these people were before they played on the biggest stages in the world, and we'll share our wildest, most unbelievable, and yes, most embarrassing moments while on tour. In this episode, we're talking to Orianthi Panagaris. Ori, as most of us know her, was the lead guitar player for Michael Jackson on his ill-fated This Is It tour. We go deep into her final days rehearsing with Michael and the devastating aftermath of his passing. In contrast, we also dive into some hysterical stories embracing theatrics while touring the world with the godfather of shock rock, Alice Cooper. Ori has shared the stage and collaborated with some of the biggest names in music, among them Prince, Carrie Underwood, Richie Sambora, and Billy Gibbons, all while having a booming solo career. Her new album, Oh, topped the charts in the first week out. Though her story wasn't always so glamorous, it is certainly one of resilience. We begin with how she went from being severely bullied in high school to playing in an arena right there in her hometown of Adelaide, Australia, with Carlos Santana. Here's my conversation with Orianthi. Orianthi, welcome to my show. It's such an honor to sit down with you today.
Hey, it's awesome to see you again.
All right, on. Well, like I'm thinking about it, and there's like really no end to the superstars that you've played with. But what's so cool about you is that you've developed your own identity apart from all of them, and you've been really successful in your own solo career as well. Before we get into all your amazing experiences and crazy tour stories, let's fill in the listeners who don't know a little more about how you got started. I understand that your dad was a guitar player and your mentor. And as I've learned, you heard him play with Jimi Hendrix when you were like 6 years old and there was really no looking back.
Oh yeah. No, my dad was definitely a reason why I picked up a guitar at 6 years old, because he would be playing around the house and he's a left-handed player, you know, so he'd be playing along with Hendrix and he's Greek. So I'm half Greek, right? So he'd be playing in a Greek band every other weekend. And so I'd join him, but I'd go past the sort of living room and he'd always be cranking like, you know, Band of Gypsies or like Cream or something like that. I'm like, that's freaking cool. Like, I want to be able to do that. And it was also like a good thing for me to sort of connect with my dad too, hang out with him. And every time I walk past a guitar, I'm like, that's just freaking, there was something that really kind of drew me to it, mm-hmm. to pick it up. And it was like this thing where this pull, yeah. right? And so I picked it up and I learned, the first chord I learned was A chord, right? And he taught me, you know, my dad taught me initially, and then he took me to a teacher, and I studied classical guitar mm-hmm. when I was about 10 years old. So I started when I was six, took me to a classical teacher, 10 years old, studied TAFE, which is like the university in Australia.
Yeah, sure.
And I learned sight reading and scales and that kind of stuff. But it actually reminded me of school, which I didn't like. Mm-hmm. I didn't like the authority situation of being told what to do.
And
right?
the homework and having to,
It was like, you know, it was kind of, you know, I like the fact, the reason why I picked the guitar, because it kind of sense, to me, it was like a sense of freedom. Mm-hmm. It was like a tool of freedom.
Sure.
Of endless possibilities, yeah. you know. And so as kind of intimidating a guitar can look too, right? Because every time, you know, you look at it and you're like, oh my God, every time I pick it up, it's like I play it differently, you know, and it's always like I'm always trying to learn more as well. You know, going through the whole classical thing, I learned, you know, I got to stage two and whatever in TAFE University, and then I joined it was called Oklahoma. It was like this like theater production. So I mm-hmm. traveled with this orchestra around Australia okay. and did this
right.
in the orchestra pit, right, when I was like 11. And then I saw Santana perform and he played Europa. And that was like the moment where I'm like, I'm playing electric. And I said to my dad, I want a PRS guitar. I was a little brat because I'm like, can you please get me a PRS? I kept on begging him every day. And then we found this guy who had a secondhand PRS guitar from the 80s, one of the first PRS made, right, in Australia. And he was a country player, so I had like super heavy strings and like high action. And my dad bought it for me. And I remember that just being like the Holy Grail. Like this was like, yeah. you know, something that I'd been dreaming of like since listening to Abraxas and watching Carlos perform Europa, because that's the most for me, that's the most beautiful instrumental ever written.
Oh, that's amazing.
You know what I mean? Like that is like the melodically and the way his tone, everything about it is just so beautiful. And I was like, that moved me. And the power of music really kind of came over me at 11 when I was sitting kind of in the nosebleed area with my dad watching Carlos play that. And I'm like, wow, that's what I want to do. I want to be able to play electric guitar.
So that was the sort of the jumping off ground zero for you.
Oh, absolutely. I'm show. Like, classical guitar was like, that was buried for me. Yeah, like
that in one night.
Oh, in one night. Yeah. Carlos did that. It was a Dance the Rainbow Serpent tour. And I was like literally blown away by his performance, his tone. And it was like, you know, it was his voice. And I was like, you can pull those tones out of a guitar and move people. And the feeling you got, it's like going to church.
Yeah, sure.
You know, and yeah, because there's no divide. Everyone's mm-hmm. together. Everyone feels the same thing. It doesn't matter what nationality or whatever. And so that magic of music, there's nothing more powerful. And I wanted to do that. So
yeah,
the fact that my dad was able to find me a PRS, a secondhand one from this player, and I just sat there obsessively, didn't do homework, by the way. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I was really good at writing excuse letters to the teachers. And I'll just sit there for 5-6 hours a night trying to study Carlos's solos and then Eric Clapton, Jimi Hendrix, Stevie mm-hmm. Ray.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah. I mean, my first guitar wasn't quite a PRS. It was a $5 acoustic nylon string guitar from Tijuana. And I was so happy. I was like 12 years old. So happy. I just started crying because it was mine. It wasn't great, but it was mine.
You know what? That wasn't my first guitar though.
Okay.
I had a sort of a crappy, like, you know, sort of
gut string guitar.
Yeah. Yeah. That I banged on, and my dad had it, and he was like, it was a right hand one he found. And that was the first guitar I had. Then I had like a Strat, but what I consider to be my first guitar was the PRS because that's the one I was really drawn to, that really made me feel like I was looking at something so epic that I had to sort of try my hardest to try to learn guitar properly to even feel like good about playing it.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? To feel worthy of playing it.
Yeah, so I know it quickly became your passion. And then I understand you quit school at like 14 or 15 years old to focus on music.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever gave you the confidence to make that bold move at such a young age?
I hated authority. I hated people telling me what to do.
Yeah.
You know, and I was always like that. Like even when I was like 6 years old, my mom said I was a complete brat. And it was horrible because I'd go into schools and demand to actually meet the headmaster before I would go to the school. Because
mm-hmm.
I'm like, I want to suss this guy out. You know, it was like really ridiculous. And then when I was like 14, I'm like, you know, I don't like the structure of all this, like being told what to do and doing like algebra and this stuff I'm never going to use. Like I want to do music. That's my calling.
Amazing. You know? Yeah.
And so I literally went on the last day of school with blue glitter all over my face. I found these butterfly clips and I did my hair up into this very bizarre.
This is awesome.
It was a complete spectacle. I showed up really late too because
you're a rebel.
Well, yeah. I signed with the management team when I was 14 too.
Oh, I see.
So I'd already been playing with ZZ Top and Steve Vai and I was doing radio shows and traveling. So I would show up late after doing like Triple M in Australia and doing different things, you know, on radio. And I'd come in and then I'd be like, you know, just sitting in the back of the classroom. And this one time, the day I decided to leave school was when I covered myself in the glitter and it was blue glitter all over my face and, you know, butterfly clips. And then the headmaster at the time said, I need to talk to you and, you know, you're not fitting in. And then this other teacher said, I think you should pick up the harp because it's more feminine because I think you're getting too much – because I was getting bullied at school by the guys and, you know, some girls too, saying that, you know, it wasn't feminine for me to play guitar and it was really weird that I was asking for people to join a band like with B.B. King influence and people didn't know who that was. And you knew Kids on the Block and kind of Backstreet Boys and they were like, who the hell is this? And so it was this whole thing where I was just like, you know, it was kind of a whole situation. And I was just like, you know what, guys, like I'm just not – feeling it, you know, and you know, it's like, this is great structure for everybody else, but just not for me, you know?
Yeah, I hear you. But I'm curious that who were your supporters at that time? I mean, did your dad say, that's a great idea, Orianti, quit school at 14? Or
my dad was a little apprehensive, but my mother was like, yeah, you know, because she could see, and my, actually, I was just saying my dad was, because he could see my passion for music. He said, I think you should have an education. He was being really, you know, like logical about it all. And my mother was too, but at the same time, she's a little more free-spirited in a sense too. So both of them were kind of like talking to each other, I guess, and kind of came to the conclusion, okay, well, we're not going to keep her in school because she's not going to do well, because she's definitely not going to go with it. So they both then, and my dad was like very supportive after that. He's like, because he saw how passionate I was when I joined three cover bands, earned a lot of money every week, yeah, you know, when I quit. And I was really proactive. Mm-hmm. And then I learned how to record because I went to a studio and learned with an engineer how to record myself. Mm-hmm. So I learned, you know, how to mic things.
Right.
What to use, you know, all that kind of stuff. So I studied and then I recorded my first album myself when I was like 16, 17 at you know, at home.
Amazing.
And that's what got me a record deal with Interscope.
Interesting. So, yeah. So, I mean, I guess having your dad and your mom sort of at your back, you know, like.
Oh yeah, that was really supportive.
Really,
that.
Really helped. Yeah. I mean, I remember when I first started taking on music, like you, there was sort of no choice. Mm-hmm. And I just knew when I was 3 years old, I was listening to old Elvis records. My older sister was playing me and stuff. And I was watching the reactions of my sister and all of her girlfriends when they'd listen to Elvis and Little Richard and Jerry Lee Lewis and the Everly Brothers. And as a three-year-old kid, I went, that's what I want to do. Look at that. Oh, yeah. Look what's happening here.
I mean, Elvis, and, right?
Yeah, like, I know. Come on. Beatles, like, I know you love Elvis.
Honestly, that's the reason why I started playing in the first place.
Is that right?
When I was 6 years old, my dad put on the 68 comeback special.
Oh, yeah.
Right. So I saw that and I was like, he's playing his J200 and he's like sitting around. And he's, you know, like, and with everyone that he had in the band, they were sitting around in a circle and the vibe, and they played off each other and just the love for music and the way that he sang and played just really, you know, move me.
Yeah.
Like, I was like, that's cool.
Same
like,
here.
There's something going on there. Like, it's really deep. And I connected with that. And the Beatles as well.
Yeah.
When I saw them play, like, Twist and Shout. That's one of the first songs I learned. And then it was, you know, Elvis and Roy Orbison.
Yeah,
Roy
Orbison
was a huge influence on me too.
Yeah, oh, wow.
Which, you know, is kind of a thing because my dad had so many Roy Orbison, you know, records and videos, VHS. And I'd be, like, watching him and just trying to play along, like, Only the Lonely and Crying, all that kind of stuff. Like, and I'd just be playing the chords, right? And then I started songwriting when I was 6 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote my first bunch of songs when I was six. And I became, like, kind of a singer-songwriter more than a guitar player when I was six. And used to go to school and perform songs I'd written and have my friends as backup dancers.
And you planned the whole thing and, like, choreographed it?
Oh, it was all, well, it was badly choreographed. But it was interesting and entertaining, to say the least. But, you know, it was kind of like, you know, going off what I'd learned from watching all these amazing, you know, artists and being so inspired. It was just purely off inspiration and whatever, and just going with it and then feeling like elated from that. And some of the kids didn't get it. They just thought I was like weird. But my friends did because they got into it. I mean, their dancing was pretty like, you know, they were into it. You know, I have some video footage, which is embarrassing, but yeah.
Yeah, I can understand. But I just want to jump back for a second. You said that you had some bullying going on at school.
Oh, yeah.
So what was that like for you? How did you survive it? How did you deal with that?
Yeah, I was bullied pretty badly. I mean, I was pushed into lockers. Guitars of mine were like destroyed before auditions because I joined different like bands in the school. And, you know, some of the guys and girls didn't like it. And I was actually bullied more by the girls as well because they used to like just literally just beat the crap out of me. Like, I'm telling you, like, literally pushed into lockers. Like, you know, I had bruises on my freaking back and my feet and everything. And they, I don't know what was going on with their home life, but it obviously wasn't too good because I was projecting. And I learned that over, you know, amount of time because I had to come to terms with it and kind of the realization of, you know what I mean? It's like they didn't find what I was doing to be normal or fit into what their world was, whatever their perception of what I was doing. So they wanted to take it out on somebody. And because I was kind of like just peace and love and I was a hippie, I used to dress like in Bob Marley t-shirts and like Rastafari and stuff and want to just play music.
And they weren't feeling that, were they? Wow, that's, you know, I was thinking about that. You and I both share a love for Elvis and all the earliest rockers and stuff like that. And all of them, like most of the first, wait, like 10 Elvis movies were all about being a rebel and getting sort of sidelined and bullied for that. And then, of course, you know, in the third act, he becomes very popular and everyone's clapping. I mean, so, you know, rock and roll is defined by rebellion. So it's clear that you, seems like you related to him on a very deep level in terms of that, just the rebellion.
Oh, yeah. And just being true to yourself and just living your life the way that you want to live it, because you only get one life, you know. And I think that everyone has their own path. And if it's your true calling, you kind of gravitated towards that. And no one can tell you otherwise. It's like people can say, hey, you should do this, you should do that. But if you're like in your soul, know where you're supposed to go and what you're supposed to do, no one's going to kind of, you know, sidetrack you from that. So, yeah, that's the way I could sort of feel about music. And I think it's such a calling, right?
Your true inspiration, as you were just saying, was Santana. And he was the reason, I guess, that you really got into guitar. Would it be fair to say that it was a dream that you would one day get to play with him?
Oh, yeah. I mean, when I was 14 years old, I made this demo with my dad. My dad recorded it on like a Tascam. We recorded like 5 tracks. I sent it to the Santana management and I got an email from Jorge Santana, Carlos's brother, right? And he said, we've been playing your record in the offices here and we love it. And Carlos really digs it too. And I was like, oh my God, that was like freaking insane.
Unreal.
Right? And then Pori Smith heard it. I sent it to everybody. When I was like 14, I put out a list of all the people I wanted to send it to.
Yeah.
I was like already like going, this is what I want to do.
Yeah.
So I got a list of like different record execs in Australia, from Sony to Universal, this kind of stuff, in America. And I just sent it out to people and the feedback was pretty positive and good. And I was like, all right, that's cool. Well, then maybe this is the right path and I'm just going to try harder. And then when I was 18, Carlos came to Australia and he was playing the Memorial Drive, 15,000 people, right? And so
is that in Adelaide?
In Adelaide, Australia, yeah.
Okay.
So I bombarded him with press kits and stuff like that.
Which is your hometown.
Hometown, yeah.
Yeah.
And I was playing out the night before with my cover band until 4 a.m., whatever. And I was so sleep deprived. And then I got a call the next morning going, Carlos wants to meet you. A sound check. Come there at like 12 o'clock. So I'm sleep deprived and like hungover. So I go there and we start jamming. And he's like, I'll play your guitar, you play mine. We jam backstage. And then he's like, you're joining me on stage tonight. And I'm like, okay. He didn't tell me what songs we're playing or anything. So I just followed him on stage. I was up there for like 45 minutes just playing because I'd learned most of his songs anyway, right?
Yeah, sure. He's your idol. He's your guitar idol.
Yeah. And it was crazy because got up there and he turned to me and was like, you play the solo. And I was like, oh my gosh, I have to find the key. I had to find all this kind of stuff. And it was like this, it was a very surreal experience. And I got to tell you, I'll never forget that. I was 18, being on stage with Carlos, same lineup as Sacred Fire, live in Mexico.
Unreal.
You know.
Yeah.
I used to wear that VHS out, you know what I mean? Like video out. It was like worn out because I literally like tried to learn Samba Patty to like, you know, everything was on there. You know what I mean? So it was a crazy time and Carlos was just so supportive. And then after that, I just went to NAMM. I saved up and then my mom would come with me and then, you know, we'd just go to the NAMM show and would just keep on playing in the Pori Smith booth.
Yeah.
And I eventually got a deal with Jimmy Iovine from Interscope Records. You know, I got a call first and then waited like a while because I wasn't sure what was going on. I didn't know if they wanted me or not. And then I had so many animals. We had this rabbit which chewed the phone cord. So we didn't have a phone for like 2 or 3 days. And apparently Jimmy was trying to call through to say you got a record deal.
You're kidding me.
And the rabbit chewed the phone cord. So
rabbit chewed the phone cord.
That freaking rabbit. Called Gaston, actually.
Gaston the rabbit.
Rabbit.
Okay, that's the end of rabbits in your life. Okay.
Oh, yeah, and that was my sister's rabbit. It was kind of weird.
Amazing.
I used to eat too many cookies, and I think it died from obesity. But anyway.
From the cookies and the telephone cord.
Probably.
I mean, it's not a good combo. You can't eat both of them. Not at the same time, anyway.
It's fucking weird.
No, but tell me this then. How did he get through to you if he missed your phone call? I guess.
He looked
at that as a challenge and just kept reaching out. How did he find you?
Well, I think 3 days later when we got, no, 2 days later when we got the phone call fixed, he called through and said, you have a record deal. So, yeah.
That is hilarious. That's my favorite record deal story ever. Oh, God. You've heard it first, ladies and gentlemen. Gaston chewed the telephone cable, but Jimmy Iovine did not give up. That's right. Jimmy Iovine, who... engineered, gosh, what? All
everything, pretty much.
So
Bruce
many.
Springsteen to like everybody, right?
Yeah, and then became the biggest mogul in the music visit, Interscope Records. A great story. He chased you down. Gaston was not going to fail him. So even though you've worked with Steve Vai and you've been on stage with Santana, would you consider your breakout, that Grammy show you did in 2009 with Carrie Underwood, given the fact that that was the night that you were spotted by Michael Jackson's musical director?
You know, that was a crazy evening. What happened was I started my record with Howard Benson, right?
Yeah.
So I was in there recording my album, signed with Interscope, was doing that. And then I changed management. I was with 19 Entertainment. Simon Fuller was my manager. And Carrie Underwood was under the 19 Entertainment thing with the Idol. And she decided to choose me as a guitar player for that evening, which is really cool. And Simon, and they were just in talks, and they said, would you do it? And I was like, oh my God, the Grammys is like epic. Absolutely, I'd be honored. So they got me up there playing Last Name. And, you know, Carrie's such a sweet, amazing person and just an incredible singer, incredible singer. And so when that curtain dropped, and I was like walking past B.B. King and sat with him in the green room beforehand, and it was like Bono's walking past you and all these things. I'm like going, oh my God, I was sitting in my pajamas, sitting on the couch watching this shit before when I was younger, you know? So it was really daunting. And then Keith Urban introduced us, and then I just got there and the curtain drops and we just start playing, and I'm like, this is crazy, amazing. And it was just a fun evening. It was really fun. Carrie was just so, you know, she said, this is what we're born to do. Don't be nervous. It's just play and have fun. And she really was so cool, and she's a friend of mine and very sweet, and the band were awesome. And after that, I guess Kenny Ortega was in the audience, right? And Michael Bearden, who's the MD, and Michael Jackson.
Kenny Ortega was the choreographer, right?
Yeah, he was a very integral part of the whole, like, this is it thing. So he was there, and then Michael Jackson had, for some reason, was on YouTube and saw me, and Carlos Santana mentioned me to him. And a few other people, and Michael Bearden. So I got a message through MySpace when I was working with Diane Warren.
Ah, yes, MySpace.
MySpace was relevant. But yeah, it was like when I was in the studio, and I got this message through MySpace, and I was recording with Diane Warren, which was like an honor. And I said, and halfway through, I get this like alert. I don't know. I just got this alert on my phone. I said, MySpace message. And I was like, and I said to Diane, I'm like, so Michael Jackson wants me coming in tomorrow. I got to learn Beat It tonight. She's like, what? You know,
wow.
This whole thing is going on. And she's like, really? And I'm like, I don't know if it's legit or not. I don't know if this guy's a weirdo, but I'm going to send it through my manager. So I sent it to my manager. He's like, no, it's legit. You got to learn Beat It. Want to be signing something in Dirty Diana. You only got a few hours because you got to learn it tonight and then get on the phone and then get there tomorrow morning first thing for Michael. And so Michael called me that night, and he's like, I've been watching your YouTube videos, and you know, I really dig what you do, and I really want you to be part of This Is It. Can you learn Beat It and these songs and come in tomorrow and play them for me? And I want to hear them really loud. And I'm like, oh, okay, awesome. So I'm a blues rock guitar player, but I'd never really listened to that much of, you know, Eddie Van Halen, all the tapping stuff, you know what I mean? So I didn't really have to get into that.
Yeah.
So, you know, my whole thing that night was I tried to play it like Eddie, but I just couldn't because I'm not that kind of player, you know, and you can't feel Eddie Van Halen's shoes. I mean, hell. You know, so, or Jennifer Batten. So I'm like, you know what? I'm going to play the solo the way that I would play it as an artist.
Yeah.
So that's the way, the approach I took to it. And I'm like, if he doesn't dig it, then at least I'm being true to myself.
Yeah, that's right. Then you wouldn't be the right call for it.
Yeah, I wouldn't be the right call, and I'd be cool with that because I'm not going to try to be something I'm not and try to fill shoes that I can't.
Right on.
You know what I mean? So
right on. Good
I was
move.
Being like really, and I came to that sort of conclusion after like hours. So I'm like, that's going to happen. So I'm just going in there and I played the solo with the right notes, but just with my feel to it, right?
Right.
He's like, I love it. You're hired that night, right? So I was like literally crying. I was like, are you kidding me? This is like crazy. I didn't tell anybody. I didn't tell Interscope. I didn't tell anyone. So I just, because they were indecisive about what direction I should go, country, pop, rock, whatever. So I'm like, you know, I'm not going to tell anybody yet. Then Kenny Ortega goes into Ron Fair's office, and then Ron Fair texts me, I heard the news, you know, and I'm like, congratulations. So he was like really happy, and everyone's actually really happy about it all. So it turned out to be a really positive thing. Unfortunately, it ended really tragically, but I just feel very blessed to have been part of that whole thing, you know, for like 2 or 3 months.
Yeah, I'm not clear. So it was like 2 or 3 months of rehearsals
maybe
before
more.
That happened.
I don't even know. But yeah, it was solid. They booked out the Staples Center, booked out the Forum, booked out, you know, I mean, it was a lot of money put into all this stuff. We had our apartments already set out in London, ready to go for the O2 tour. Mm-hmm. Had a guitar made, which had rockets coming out of it and mm-hmm. lasers and all this stuff. It was crazy.
Did he ask for that, or is that something that you thought of?
He asked for it, and then the other guitar that was made, the one prior to that, was covered in Swarovski crystals. It was very heavy. Like, it was completely covered in Swarovski.
Is that something that was his idea, or it was the
his
Swarovski?
Idea. Oh, yeah, because I brought in my guitar, and it was blue, and he's like, this is too plain. I'm like, all right. He's like, let my clothes designer come in with my, you know, the person who's covering everything. He has giant, like, tarantula or whatever it is covered in Swarovskis. So everything was covered in crystals.
And now it weighed 19 pounds.
Oh, it was really heavy. I mean, PRS is slightly heavy, but this was, like, bedazzled and heavier but cool. And when I saw it, it was, like, blinding. And it was great. And then the rocket thing as well, it was crazy. So the whole thing was, like, extravagance to the nth. I mean, you know, there was nothing that you couldn't dream up that couldn't be made. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? So it was insane. And he was like the sweetest person to work for. He was the sweetest boss. And I had the best time working with Michael. I mean, honestly, it was truly an experience I'll never forget. And I'm very blessed to have spent that time with him.
No doubt about it. Unfortunately, as you said, tragedy struck while you were rehearsing and Michael, you never toured. What was the craziest thing that happened during those rehearsals besides the 19-pound Swarovski crystal guitar?
Oh, there was so much crazy stuff. I mean, like, from the fans to the people that would come rushing in, the security, and like, it was a different realm of reality. I've never experienced anything like it, to be honest with you. I mean, it's just so much money was thrown into it. So anything you wanted, you got, mm-hmm. basically, right? So
amazing.
Then you have cameras following you around. Even when I went to the refrigerator to get some berries that were following me, literally everything was filmed. It was like Big Brother or something. You know
oh,
what I mean?
Yeah.
So it was pretty intense. And I got to tell you, the paparazzi, everything after that was insane. I had paper cuts being pushed around. Everyone that was kind of part of it, and I guess they used this clip of me playing with Michael, they don't care about us on the news when he passed, you know? So I had paparazzi outside my door. I had TMZ following me around with my sister.
I can imagine, yeah.
20%, like all the time. Aww. Happened for like about a good year, you know what I mean, after that. And then Interscope were like, we're putting out your record, like literally a month after. So I was on a tour, you know, promoting my album and single, which went platinum around the world, you know what I mean, which was great. But I was still dealing with the grief of that too. So it was kind of like this, I had a therapist, not a psychiatrist, but a therapist that I worked with, because it was really hard for me to deal with the emotions of, it wasn't just losing a tour, it was losing a friend. It was losing the friendship.
Yeah, he'd become a friend with you.
Oh, everybody, you know what I mean? Yeah. It became like your boss, and just, I guess, getting caught up in the whole thing of, when you're musicians and you play together and that sense of friendship and between everybody in the mm-hmm. band, mm-hmm. that's what kind of, and it was all gone overnight. You know what I mean? And then his life and everything, and you go, how did that happen? Like, how can someone's life be taken away when he seemed completely fine and good and, you know, good spirits, everything? It was just very mind boggling and hurtful. For everybody, we're all very upset. So,
sure.
And the world was, I mean, obviously.
But, obviously, yeah, it was a global thing. Was he as intense as a band leader as we might think he is? What was he like in terms of leading the rehearsal? Was that more Michael Bearden? Was he very demanding during the long days of rehearsal?
Yeah, MJ was incredibly intense.
Yeah.
Michael Bearden was very intense too. Yeah, I mean, he heard everything, you know, because it was about parts. It was about how to make this sound the best it could. So even when my guitar tone wasn't right on point, can you try this? Can you try that? I even had Paul Smith make me a PRS, which sounded a little like a telly sometimes, you know, it had like more of that bite to it and change the pickups and stuff like that. So it would cut through and, you know, for those funky parts. So it would sound really similar to the parts of like Want to Be Starting Something or Thriller and all those, you know, the rhythmic sort of
the funk stuff. Yeah, the single note funk stuff.
The little mm-hmm. things, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And Michael could hear all that stuff. He wanted to hear it loud. So
yeah, sure.
There was no faking it. You had to have the real deal. And he's like, can you use this different guitar? Can you get something else different? He would hear everything. I'm telling you, that guy, he was on point. And when people say, oh, he was on different things or whatever it was, to be that on point, I don't believe it. Because I mean, I'm telling you, if you're spaced out and you're on shit, you can't hear that. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like he was so on it.
Yeah.
Like, he's like, I need you to change that guitar tomorrow. And I'm like, sure, absolutely. I need that part changed for the bass, or I need that part changed for whatever, or the singing or whatever. And he was like so adamant about every part, to the dancing, to the overall production. That guy was working overtime.
Amazing. Yeah. Well, that explains it. I mean, for me with Paul, there's been several times where he'd come to any of us and say, hey, can you try a little thinner sound? And, you know, we do our best to sort of emulate the records that we were raised on, because they're sort of in our blood. They're in our DNA. Those Beatles Wings and Paul solo songs are, you know, they're part of our vocabulary. So what are you going to do? Say, no, I don't have that sound. You're going to dig around until you find that sound. Did he end up feeling happy with the sounds when you were going for that thinner sound that he was describing? Was he happy with it?
He seemed content after that, of course. Yeah. I mean, because he, you know, then he wanted me to come up with a part at the end of like Black or White, which was called Aftermath. And it was like this destruction part where everything was like falling. He's like, can you write something for the end of that? And I was like, sure. So then that night I wrote this part and then we just performed it for him. He loved it, which was really cool. The whole experience, I got to tell you, was amazing. I got to play on his last record too.
Mm-hmm.
So I played a solo on a song called Monster with 50 Cent.
Amazing. That really cool. Wow, that's amazing. Yeah. And so you didn't really notice like he was rehearsing under a lack of sleep. He was still really present, really intense that whole time.
I mean, yeah, you could tell that he was overworked. There's no question about that.
And was the tour ready to go?
Yeah.
It was ready to roll out.
Oh, yeah, ready to go, for sure.
Oh, my God. What a loss.
Yeah.
Well, so since you never got to tour with Michael, I guess Alice Cooper was really your first big world tour. Is that right?
Yeah, well, I toured with my own band and had a platinum single with
According to You. It's huge.
Went number one, which was great. And it was platinum in Japan, Australia, and America.
Great song, by the way.
You know, that song was actually written by Steve Diamond and Andrew, I think it's Andrew Frampton. And then I, you know, added my stuff to it as well with the 80s guitar tapping solo and everything. I'm like, if I'm going to do something on pop radio, I'm putting an 80s tapping guitar solo in there. So every kid wants to play guitar.
There you go.
That's going to be the point of difference. I've said, I'm not Miley Cyrus. I'm not any of these, you know, they're great artists. They're great pop singers and dance and everything, but I'm not that. I'm a guitar player.
Right.
So sure, if I want to have an empowering song, but I want to also put in that guitar solo where everyone could play along to. And it got on Guitar Hero. There was so much stuff that, you know, came along with it. And
great
inspired,
video too. Yeah.
Yeah, and a great director. And it really inspired a lot of kids to want to play guitar because I thought it was cool. When I put down the guitar solo, I thought, oh my God, they're going to, and I left the studio. I'm like, they're going to hate this shit. I'm like, but you know what? Why not? And then Ron Fair calls and says, I love it. It's different. It's cool. Add more guitar playing to it. I'm like, all right. And honestly, the reaction from it was really great. I mean, I worked my ass off in promoting it and meeting with every radio programmer around the country for like 2 to 3 months solid with my guitar player. We just went around and met everybody. We did 2 cities in one day.
Mm-hmm.
No sleep, right? Mm-hmm. Just constant, like pushing it and handshakes, meet and greets, all that kind of stuff. Would you play my song? Would you please play my song? You know, all that kind of stuff. That stuff works.
Yeah.
Because you make that personal connection and you know, some of the interviews were like pretty grueling. I mean, you know, you get up so early, you don't sleep, you're asked these pressing questions, very emotional. It was mixed. But honestly, it all paid off in that sense in getting the song out there and as an artist and then being able to tour, you know, extensively in Japan, having a best of record in Japan and then Asia and then playing all the festivals and Summer Sonic and you know what I mean? And then people are singing back your songs, like 100,000 people.
It's huge, yeah. Putting in that sweat equity and all that time, all that, what they used to call elbow grease to sort of promote yourself, and it worked to watch that rise up the charts and gain that kind of success. It must have been really satisfying for you.
It was it was kind of crazy because like when you're playing Japan and they don't really speak English, that, you know, well, some do, but not everybody. And they're singing back the lyrics to According to You and you're playing 100,000 people, right? It's like, that's like a drug in itself. It's like, holy shit. You know what
that's
I mean?
Right.
It's like, wow. And then you go, all right, then after that, how do I be normal? You know what I mean? And so it's trying to find the balance. I think I think, you know, as a musician, you know, we go from a zero to 100 all the time. Yeah,
zero to hero, right.
Yeah, zero to 100. And then you've got to find a way to deal with normal life and sort of like go, okay, how do I normalize? I'm a homebody. Like when I'm home, I love my animals. I love cooking. I love my friends. I love the normal crap, right?
Yeah.
Of things, right?
Yeah.
But then I love playing the big shows.
Yeah.
And then when I'm not playing shows, I'm going crazy. So mm-hmm. there's like this whole thing, right? I got to get back in the studio. I got to be writing with other people, doing stuff, like just being a service, you know, to music because I feel that you're calling for it. So if I have too much time off, I'm a weirdo. No one wants to be around me.
Come on. Away. When was it that Alice reached out to you, Alice Cooper?
I played the finale of American Idol with Alice. We played Schools Out.
And, oh, yeah.
And then I did some session work with Bob Ezrin. So I played on Fifi Dobson's record. Her, you know, she had a big single in Canada, Can't Breathe. So I played the guitar solo on that over Skype with Bob. And then Alice called me when I was in Nashville making my record with Dave Stewart from the Eurythmics. And he called me after I finished the record. It was like literally the last day. He's like, Ari, I need a guitar player. It's like Alice, right?
Oh, going, wow.
He's like, my guitar player just left for Thin Lizzy, and I need you to learn everything in a week.
And how many songs was that?
25.
Oh, my God.
So I was like, sure, absolutely, that sounds great. And then I listened to them. I'm like, there's like, this is hard.
Yeah,
this is
it's,
hard
it's
shit.
Like fog like rock. It's not typical.
No, it's like Frank Zappa.
Yeah.
And every guitar player that when they recorded it was in a different drug. But it was like somehow very well orchestrated with Bob Ezra and everybody that worked around. So it was like incredible. And then Steve Hunter, who's like an incredible guitar player. And I was like
legendary.
And he was part of the band when I joined, you know, Steve. So it was me and Steve with Tommy Henriksen, who's incredible too, and Chuck Garrick and Glenn Sobel. So I wanted to hear Steve really loud in my ears because he was just inspiring. And incredible. So learning all those songs, I literally told my friends, I'm sorry, but I can't see you for a week and I'm on lockdown and I have to learn these songs. They're very difficult. And then Damon Johnson, who I replaced in the band, came out. I said, I need your help. You got to fly in, Damon, because there's no way I'm going to learn and retain basically all the parts in a week. You know, Halo of Flies was a 9-minute long song.
Yeah.
Like 9 minutes long. And there's all these different parts and they're all, and it's not like it's difficult parts. They're just melodic parts you got to remember.
Yeah, sure. You know? It's more orchestral in a way.
Very orchestral. Yeah. And so Damon was like, okay, I'm going to sit down with you and go through it. And he said, if you take it part by part, you're going to remember it. And he was really wonderful, Damon. I've got to say, he really saved the day for me because without that, I wouldn't have known how to really take it on because it's like, you know, it was a bit overwhelming for me, to be honest. And I just finished my record. I was ready to put that out and promote that. I was like, no, I'm going to go with Alice because this is Alice Cooper. I mean, he's incredible. And so I was part of that whole Rocky Horror crazy show with pythons and swords. And I was an irritable zombie for like 4 years. And it was wonderful. I was covered in blood. I had like, I Love the Dead written on my arms. And I loved it. I loved every minute of it because I got to tell you, Alice Cooper and Cheryl are the nicest people you ever meet.
Amazing. What a performer, too. What's the craziest story that you have from that tour?
I have many crazy stories. I mean, I nearly got stabbed in the head by one of the swords and I nearly got a confetti cannon going off up my butt because I was playing a solo in front of it. That would have been a really awkward hospital visit. And then I got stuck in an elevator in Perth, Australia, which felt 5 stories. This was like the first time we went out on tour and I got to the hotel room in Perth. I got my key. I was the only person in the elevator and it decided to just break, I guess.
The elevator.
Yeah, elevator. And it was a really high hotel by the beach and everything in Perth. And it just decided to fall 5 or 6 stories, like down, right? And I was like, these like magazines. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm dying. For some reason, I'd read somewhere like if an elevator is falling, you should flatten yourself so your spine doesn't jar. So I'm like flattened across the ground like a weirdo. And this
as it's in mid-fall, you did that?
Yeah. So
pretty smart. I like that. I'll have to remember that.
Down because it doesn't jar your spine.
Sure.
Right? So you just you can fall with the elevator and you don't die. Mm-hmm. So
good plan. I like that plan. You don't want to die.
We had a rescue team come out with oxygen and everything. It was really dramatic, really dramatic. Anyway, so there's a wedding going on too at the time. There's all these bridesmaids and I was stuck between two levels, right? So they finally got a wrench and they got me out. And I was like looking like death because like 20 hours of flying from LA. You know, I come out of the elevator and I'm like, everyone's dressed up like properly for the wedding. I'm like, don't get in that freaking elevator. It's freaking possessed. And I'm like yelling at everybody because I'm like sleep deprived. And they're like looking at me like, oh my God, this girl's like insane. I'm like.
Well, it's a good thing you weren't in zombie makeup because then you would have really caused a scene.
Oh my God. Yeah. No. And then I went and bought myself a Martin guitar.
As a result of that?
Oh yeah. I went to a guitar store straight after that. I got to buy
a little retail therapy.
Oh my God. Yeah. Guitar stores for me and hat stores. That's where I go.
I feel you. Well, as far as guitars, not as much the hats, but yeah, guitars. Ever since I was a kid, like when I was 12 years old, I remember getting on the number 9 bus and put a quarter in the slot of the bus and take it down to Santa Monica and do this tour of pawn shops and music stores that would take me all day on Saturday. I'd start off with a big old plate of French fries and a Coca-Cola and get all starched and sugared up, caffeined up. And I'd do this routine like 6 guitar stores, starting with pawn shops and build up to the best one, Ace Music. But I was an addict. At the end of the day, they'd say, when my mom would come pick me up, we were going to start charging you for babysitting. You know, that was what I was into when I was like 13 years old. So you got the Martin. Did that fix it for you?
Yeah, it did for a minute. I felt good because I took it back to my room. I'm like, I'm just going to sit here with this guitar and I'm feeling good about this purchase. And I nearly died. And it was really funny because when I got downstairs, they're like, we feel so terrible. What happened? We're going to upgrade you to the suite. And I was like, where's the suite? On the 20th floor. I'm like, you know, I don't want the suite. I want the freaking first floor. Shit. Okay. Like, I don't want to get in the elevator. Right. So you can upgrade somebody else to the suite.
Good news is you have a suite. The bad news is you got to get back on that elevator.
Yeah. So it was a really funny, terrifying, but funny in the end experience. I mean, there's so many things that happen with the Alice Cooper tour. I mean, I got to tell you,
there's a guillotine on stage.
Real swords.
Too. Yeah, real swords.
Yeah.
Snakes. Yeah. Huge boa constrictors. There's a snake minder.
Yeah. There's a python, little boa peep, I think it was, or...
Little boa peep. I like
that. Wasn't so little. She lived on the bus and the generator broke. So she was out on the couch as I was pouring my coffee one morning. And I was just like, it was staring at me. It was beady eyes, like just staring at me, like fixated. And I was like, oh my God, I can't do this. Like, I'm tired. I want my coffee. And this freaking python staring at me. And so I went and woke up Glenn, the drummer. And I was like, Glenn, you got to wake up. Like, I can't deal with this. I'm trying to pour my coffee and this boa is looking at me and he wants to eat me. He's like, okay, I'm waking up. So, and then Kyla, he works with Alice. He came out and dealt with it. But I was just like, and apparently they're really attracted to pheromones. So if you're wearing perfume, which I pretty much crop dust myself and Tom Ford, right? He's like eyeing me, you know, like looking at me like, I want to eat you or just take a chunk out of flesh. But apparently, I don't know, a makeup artist or somebody had a chunk of their arm taken out by one of the pythons because she was wearing this cream which had perfume on it. So it was definitely after me and I could sense that because it was like kind of like hovering, like looking at me. Like I was like, okay, no, this is not
cool. Wow, he was stalking you.
Yeah, that was weird. You know, there was a lot of weird experiences, but I got to tell you, overall, that tour was a blast. And I have, you know, such amazing memories because such a beautiful family environment with Alice and the boys and and Cheryl and Calico and everyone. Just beautiful people. They really are.
That's so cool. Well, listen, we're going to wrap it up now with our lightning round we like to call the encore. So there's a non-glamorous side of what we do, and that's the travel. What's the craziest travel story besides the boa that's happened to you? And was there a moment of this is really not as fun as I thought it would be?
Oh, my God. So many times. I mean, you know, for the first tour, when I was touring around with my tour manager and band, I'd be doing a lot of press and going to Asia a lot and going to Japan, I think 10 times in 1 year. We had to get passed through China one time and I had not slept in a week because I just like constant, probably like half an hour naps in between, right? Mm-hmm. So I was delirious as hell. So apparently I got put in a dark room in China, questioned and all this stuff. I don't even remember. And my tour manager said to me, like, you blacked out because you had been sleep deprived and you hadn't slept in a week. And mind you, I wasn't drinking. I wasn't doing anything. This was just severe sleep deprivation, you know, from just overwork. So that was weird. And then I guess just trying to pick yourself up after, you know, flight after flight and just not remembering which city you're in and, you know, you get on stage and you're just like, oh my God, like, and just taking too much B12. I remember I was taking like too much B12 to the point that it was giving me anxiety. Like I thought it was like helping me, but there is a point where you can take too much of it.
So, well, good to know, good to know.
Yeah.
So it's been said that tragedy plus time equals humor. What's the most embarrassing thing that has happened to you on stage and how did you get through it?
One of the funniest stories, which I found to be very humorous, I used to wear these big hair extensions, you know, quite the, it was really unmanageable, actually. It was really annoying. But so my bass player was running past me and she got her headstock of her bass caught in my hair extension. And it took two songs to separate us. And it was a Montreal festival, 20,000 people filmed in Canada. And I think what was really funny because everyone in the front row were kind of like just looking like, when are they going to separate? Like, who's going to, how's this going to happen? So I think like it actually added to the show of like the, you know, kind of like, how's this going to happen?
How's it going to end?
I know. And she's like pulling her neck and I was like, my hair was going and I was like trying to sing and I was like on the mic and it was the weirdest shit. And then like they finally, two techs came out. So we had the drum tech came out, the guitar tech came out and they finally pulled it and she had hair stuck to her headstock. And she was convinced she was being fired after this, right? And the tour manager was playing some games with her, saying, oh, he's going to fire you after this. This is not good. And so I walked on the bus and I was like, oh, no, you know what? I said, Vivi, and she's wonderful. She's an incredible bass player. I said, Vivi, I love you. Like, this is funny. It added to the show. People were like suspense. Like, when is the hair going to come out? When are you guys going to get separated? This is weird shit. Very Spinal Tap. And then I said, it was great. Entertainment value. That's what it's all about. You know, I said, all good, all good. So then she has, so funny, she had her leg out, or I think she did or somebody else did, maybe my assistant at the time. But anyway, had their leg out of their bunk. So I go running without even looking because it was all dark into my bunk to go to sleep. I get severe concussion.
Oh, no.
Because the leg hits me on the side of the head where it just blacked me out. So I pass out and crawl into bed. I'm asleep for 17 hours.
Holy.
But no one wanted to wake me because I thought, oh, that poor girl, she's so sleep deprived. We're not going to wake her. She'd get mad. So I could have died from being, you know.
Concussed, and going to sleep.
Yeah. And then so I have this like big bruise on my head and I wake up and everyone was like staring at me when I wake up with like wide eyes like, wow, you slept all the way through to like almost sound check time. And I'm like, that was the best sleep I ever had. And I said, I remember getting hit on the head. And they said, oh my gosh, Ari, you have a huge bruise on your head. So we had a doctor come in. It was like severe concussion. And you know what? It was all good. So that was kind of a crazy story.
Do you personally have a pre-show tradition or are there any superstitions that you have?
For me, it's definitely about just gathering the band together and having that time together before the show and putting hands in a circle and then shouting something. And whatever that word is or phrase is, that we all do it together. And then having a bit of alone time is really important to me as well.
Right on.
Beforehand. You know, it's about togetherness and it's about like, you know, we're all playing for real. We're not miming. So you never know what's going to happen. A guitar strap could break, a string could break, whatever could happen, a drumstick could break. You never know, you know, and all these things could come in your head. But ultimately, and I have a certain thing where I like to wear my, you know, moonstone rings or I have my crystals and I'm very much about energy, you know, I'm very much about that. So it's really important
to me. So certain rings and certain jewelry.
Turquoise for me.
Yeah.
Like I have a signature strap line, which I just created just now with Carlino Guitars. And it has turquoise all on the straps, right?
Nice.
Which is really cool. And then, you know, I'm working with Gibson Guitars right now and doing a brand new J200, which is really cool. And incorporating crystals with that too, right?
Yeah.
So it's definitely about the energy field of thing. And I feel that music is the most powerful form of magic is music, right? And that can bring people together more than anything else can. And there's no divide, you know? And I think that everyone just kind of, you know, it's this frequency, which is healing and it brings people together and they feel the same thing. It doesn't matter what nationality, whatever your beliefs are.
Mm-hmm.
It's an incredible thing.
And who would you go see live? Let's say you didn't have any VIP access at all, that you would just stand in line with everybody. And
Oh, it would always have to be the Rolling Stones. I mean, you can't.
There you go. I kind of knew that was going to happen. Yeah.
Right?
I mean, I'm still that way too.
Right? Like yeah. they're just freaking so great. You know, it's just an incredible show. Incredible show. And when I saw you guys perform too in Vancouver, I remember that, you know, freaking amazing show.
Oh,
you know,
oh,
with
thanks.
Nicole. And yeah, I mean, honestly, I'm just a fan of music. And when it moves you and it's just like so iconic and everything's like a certain way and level too. I mean, the level of musicianship that you guys have, you know, you're playing, Paul's playing, everyone, you know, Abe, everybody, and with the Rolling Stones and all these different bands, it's like, it's funny. It's like, it's such a vibe, but it's so real and it's like, you mean it, but it's like, you're doing what's best for the song. And it's all very, you take it really seriously. And I think a lot of bands that are coming out now don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
They don't. And they got to take note.
Interesting, yeah.
You know what I mean?
You're going to take notes from Paul McCartney or
you guys,
Alice
take
Cooper.
It from the, you know, and because with Alice, we, and I'm sure you guys, like, you rehearse.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
A lot, yeah. And get the parts, you know, with the Stones, they are haphazard in a very organized way.
But they always have been.
You know what I mean?
It's like a train wreck.
Keith will play something like out there and then Ronnie Wood would just back it up solidly and then yeah. Keith would play something solid and then Ronnie would play something like out of the box and everything just fills in and then Mick would start like dancing around and playing something and then, you know, it's like it's just all works because they're so rehearsed to the fact that they know each other's instincts. And I think that once you know, it's all about dynamics, you know what I mean? It's all about presenting the songs properly and just being polished and really being at service to the music and how you present it to people and how to move people and
nice.
All of that.
Is there anything you'd be stoked to collaborate with that you haven't collaborated with?
I would love to do a collaboration with Gary Clark. We were talking the other night about
nice.
The possibility of that.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, we text each other and see what happens there, you know? But
nice.
I would love to. I'm a huge fan of Gary's. I just think that he really brings the realness of the blues and everything that, you know, he's just got this whole vibe going on, which I really dig.
So soulful, yeah. Great singer, just, too. Great player and great singer.
Yeah, we got to jam out with Rick Nelson for the whole... That was the coolest thing, you know, when you called me to do that. And that was actually with Jimmy Iovine.
That's
when
right.
When you called me, I was in his office and you called through and said, hey, were you part of this Les Paul tribute? And I'm like, absolutely, that'd be so cool. And then you're like, play these parts. I'm like, all right, so we just recorded it, you know, together after and everything, but then being able to play the live show and be a part of the, it was a Dolphins thing.
Yeah,
right?
Miami Dolphins, right?
Yeah.
A halftime show. And we had 100 kids out on the field, mm-hmm. all playing air guitar and acting cool. like they were playing, you know, basses and guitars and doing little steps. They were choreographed all for Gibson to promote music in schools.
Such a cool environment. And I remember them all just like, you know, just jamming out. It was fun. And I was out there for a week because we played the tailgate party. I played the national anthem. So Rick Nelson, he has the most precise pick throwing situation.
Unreal.
Going on.
I have
he
a story
hit me
about
right
that.
On the head.
Same here.
Right on the freaking head. I'm like, dude,
same here.
How do you do that shit?
One, I was with a guest and he threw a pick and got caught in her hair. And we're like 35 feet from the stage. I swear to God, he's like a sharpshooter with guitar picks. He flicks them, telling you, he goes like this.
And he knows exactly, oh yeah, straight.
You're right in the head.
Straight on my forehead. I'm like, dude, yeah. How do you do that? And then when I throw them and I'm like, you know, looking at a fan, it goes like the other way.
Same here. All of mine end up down in the security pit.
Yeah, it's like down. It's like, oh, it goes somewhere else. And they're like, you're an idiot. And I'm like, I know.
Well, we'll leave it there.
Thank you, everyone, for listening, and thank you to my good friend and fellow guitar slinger, Orianthi, for taking us behind the scenes into her amazing life. Be sure to check out her new album, Oh, You Won't Be Disappointed. On Tour is a production of iHeartRadio and Black Barrel Media. This show is produced by Mandy Wimmer with executive producer Noel Brown, and I'm your host, Brian Ray. For more information about On Tour, visit our website, blackbarrelmedia.com. For behind-the-scenes photos from these interviews and to interact with us, visit our social media at On Tour Pod on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. For more shows from iHeartRadio and Black Barrel Media, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.